face of it, it seems quite benign. You put a swab in your mouth, or you spit in a test tube, you place it in a plastic bag and send it off to a company who then tell you about your genetic heritage a few weeks later. But who owns the data? And what can they do with it? It's News Talk Daily. I'm Ciara Doherty. And with the publication of Ireland's 1926 census, many people have been diving back into their family histories, searching names and tracing relatives and trying to piece together where they come from. And there is something deeply compelling about it, a real sense of connection about the lives that came before us. But for some, that curiosity doesn't just stop at census records or parish registers. It goes a step further. More than 40 million people worldwide have now taken DNA heritage tests, sending off those saliva samples to learn more about their genetic origins. It is a huge global industry. Often bought as gifts, these tests are marketed as something fun, and they are for a lot of people, a bit of entertainment, a modern way to explore your roots. But unlike searching the census, it isn't just about the past, because in handing over your DNA, you're giving away something far more personal. And that raises important questions. There were concerns raised last year when one of the companies that provides this service, 23andMe, filed for bankruptcy, and it prompted questions about what happened to millions of users' genetic data. And these concerns are being raised once again in France, where, I should point out, recreational DNA testing has long been illegal. There's a striking shift in the conversation because authorities there are considering whether police should be allowed to access these commercial DNA databases to help solve cold cases. And that's a significant step. Because I don't think these databases were built with law enforcement in mind. They were built by ordinary people who were curious about their ancestry, sending off a saliva sample in search of their roots. So, is there a danger it's going to move from personal curiosity to potential policing tool? Well, joining me now is Orla Linsky. She's a professor of law at University College London. You're so very welcome to News Talk Daily.
Thanks, Ciara. It's lovely to talk to you.
And we only have to look on any of the social media channels over the last couple of days to see people going on the database of the census here in Ireland that was published at the weekend and trying to find out a bit more about their background, about their ancestors, about their lives, where they lived, what they did, how long they survived for. And again, it just reminds us that people are just endlessly curious, aren't they, about themselves, their stories, their family stories.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's a really nice link to draw between the census data and genetic testing data, because a lot of the same themes are there. People are very interested in learning more about themselves and where they've come from. And, you know, I think when you look at who accessed the census data over the past few days, what's interesting is that people are really coming from all over the world. So it's not just people currently based in Ireland. It's the UK, the US, Australia, Canada. Countries where there's been a big history of movement, obviously, and where there's a huge Irish diaspora. And I think that kind of connects in some ways to discussions around genetic data, because now what is possible is the access to that data. You know, so the digitization of the archives of Ireland has allowed for that data, that census data, to be accessed globally in just the same way that genetic testing has kind of been revolutionized over the past couple of decades in a way that now makes direct-to-consumer genetic testing affordable and accessible and, you know, easy to give someone as a Christmas or a birthday present for that bit of fun if somebody is curious about their past.
And I always think when I see people going on these databases or indeed doing that DNA ancestry, that you kind of assume what you're going to get back is going to be very innocent, innocuous, entertaining information. And people probably don't necessarily think about the fact that this information can throw up stories about your ancestors that you didn't anticipate, that perhaps aren't as fun and positive as you thought they might be.
Yeah, absolutely. And not simply ancestors, I would say. We've had some quite recent stories like litigation in the US in the past couple of years, where families that have had IVF, for example, in order to have children, have discovered that their children are not, in fact, for instance, genetically related to them because of an error in the IVF clinic. And that poses all kinds of extremely difficult quandaries that were just not foreseen when we were thinking about things like direct-to-consumer genetic testing.
For people who've never done one of those tests, what actually happens when you send off your DNA? How does it work? Where does it go? And what exactly comes back?
Yeah, so as you said in your introduction, you know, the first thing that's happening here is that you're providing a sample, so saliva in a tube or some sort of cheek swab, and that will contain your DNA cells. That's then sent off to a lab where a lab technician will isolate the DNA from those cells and look for part of your genetic code. So they're not looking at the whole genome sequence. So the whole code, although, you know, that is increasingly becoming possible at scale and at a lower cost, but they're isolating parts of it called SNPs, and they're looking at the places where you're likely to have differentiation between individuals. And then, you know, where they see that differentiation, they're then comparing that against a kind of a reference database. And that's where, if, for example, you're looking at your ancestry, they're trying to see to what extent you might have European heritage, for instance, or whatever it is. And that comparison against a reference database is used to generate a statistical model or an algorithmically generated report that gives you things like the percentage of X or Y ancestry that you might have, or your genetic predispositions to certain things, or, you know, also in some situations, potential traits that you might have, or health conditions. So at the end of the day, what you get is a report that gives you a kind of statistical breakdown of the probability of you having certain characteristics.
It has become incredibly popular, as I said in the outset. 40 million people worldwide have taken these DNA heritage tests. It's a huge industry.
Yeah, it's a massive industry, and it's growing, I think, is also very important to note. So we have, you know, it's about $40 billion last year, but they estimate that over the next decade that will double. And then just even in terms of the absolute numbers of people that are using some of the commercial services, I mean, I think the ones that will be most familiar to people are Ancestry and 23andMe. And if you look at something like Ancestry, it has a database of approximately 28 million DNA samples. So that's absolutely huge. And, you know, as I said, growing.
They have 28 million DNA samples. So 28 million individuals have given their DNA to this private company.
Yes. Yeah. And 23andMe has around 50 million. So Ancestry is by far, in a way, the biggest private or, you know, commercially held genetic testing data set. But 23andMe also has a significant DNA sample set, it must be said.
Okay, so let's look at 23andMe, one of these companies, because they did file for bankruptcy last year. What happened with all of that data that they had on their books, as it were?
This was the first time that we had the issue of kind of the control or the ownership over this type of data kind of squarely considered or in the public domain in terms of litigation. So when 23andMe filed for bankruptcy, the query before the court was whether the data held could be looked at as an asset of the company, just like any other kind of tradable asset or commodity for liquidity purposes. But in those circumstances, what the court held was that it could be looked at as an asset in that way. So it can be kind of transferred in situations of insolvency, but that this transfer would happen kind of respecting the original conditions under which the data were processed. So in that situation, the court actually appointed a kind of a data protection, or it was the US, so a data privacy ombudsperson, to set out what they thought the safeguards would be or should be for the transfer of this data. And, you know, the main thing that emerged from the litigation was that the original data protection conditions would hold. And that's, you know, very similar to what would happen in the EU by default, you know, as a result of a more protective data protection policy.
In terms of that data and that volume of data, I'd imagine it is infinitely tradable.
Absolutely. And so the commercial significance of this data just couldn't be understated. You see that in the kind of numbers, the figures, in terms of the value of the industry itself. But then when you look at the privacy policies of the companies concerned, if you look, for instance, at 23andMe, you see that when it comes to things like the purposes for which the data can be processed, they're not even specified in the privacy policy. So, you know, that might be kind of implicit in the service offered, you know, because 23andMe talks about your ancestry, your traits, your predisposition to certain kind of medical issues, but it doesn't really specify in any level of detail who could access the data, you know, what other purposes it might be used for. And, you know, another kind of, I think, striking feature about 23andMe is that it also has quite significant research partnerships in relation to the data. So it has a research partnership with GlaxoSmithKline for kind of drug development pathways, but it also uses the data itself to kind of identify target drugs for medical purposes. And that is also kind of a lot less specified, I think, when you look at its privacy policy. So it has a separate privacy policy for those research purposes. And almost 80% of users of 23andMe have signed up to have their data used in that way. But the terms are relatively vague, I think it must be said. And certainly not the type of standards that you would see if, for example, I'm in the UK looking at the way in which the NHS would process data and the level of detail you get in relation to that data processing. And I'm imagining it's the same thing in Ireland with the HSE.
Okay, so what you're saying is here, look, when you send off your sample, right, you probably sign a form, a consent form that says I am giving my consent for my data to be used for all of these purposes, but that people perhaps aren't quite aware of what it is that they're signing up to.
Yeah, I think there are, you know, in terms of the specifics of the privacy policy, consent to be GDPR compliant should specify the purposes of the processing in really kind of granular, clear terms. But even if you have that consent, there are lots of other safeguards in place. Like if data is processed for one purpose, it shouldn't be processed for another incompatible one. But when you see a privacy policy like 23andMe, which doesn't actually explicitly state the purposes of processing, then even if you were trying to do your due diligence, you're just not too enlightened after reading the policy. And then, you know, if I looked at something like the research privacy policy, it says that the purpose of the data processing for research purposes is to, and this is a quote, make new discoveries and to study a wide variety of research topics. That doesn't even kind of limit it to medical research topics, you know, strictly speaking. So in that sense, it gives quite a lot of wiggle room to the companies concerned to kind of repurpose the genetic data. And I'm not saying that's what is happening, but that is facilitated, I think, by those wide clauses. And so that means then when you have data like the 15 million samples trade hands from 23andMe to the company that acquired 23andMe, then there's a lot of leeway in those terms and conditions for the repurposing of that data. The larger risk, I think, is of unanticipated use. And that could go from anything from your data, your genetic data being used for insurance premium calculation purposes to, you know, other things that would be possibly far more worrying at a societal scale.
Like what?
Well, we are seeing a resurgence of kind of ethno-nationalism, in particular in political discourse. There's a lot more focus on your ethnicity in terms of your belonging in a particular country or region or whatever that is. And genetic data sets obviously reveal ethnicity. And so, you know, when the 23andMe data set was hacked, some reports suggested that individuals had been classified according to ethnicity, like Ashkenazi Jews or Chinese descent or whatever. And so even if 23andMe planned to do nothing with that information is very potent and in the wrong hands could be used for all kinds of methods or all kinds of profiling that we just wouldn't want to see again.
There's also this idea that your DNA doesn't just belong to you, that it says something about your family too. How complicated does that make all of this?
This makes things extremely complicated. And this is something I'm particularly interested in, because genetic data is a fantastic example of where the same piece of data can relate to multiple individuals simultaneously. And, you know, we see this also with things like social media data and other things. But genetic data is perhaps like the purest example of that. So if I provide my genetic data sample to 23andMe, then this is telling you something about my children as well as my parents and, you know, various others in my family. And this really kind of shines a spotlight on the limits of any kind of model of individual control over personal data. Because it might be that I'm perfectly happy to have my data shared with 23andMe, but my children might not be. And so then we have a kind of a conflict between my right to have my personal data processed in those circumstances and their right to have, for instance, their personal data deleted. And again, this became, you know, quite a live issue after news about 23andMe's liquidation broke, because within a lot of families, there was a lot of kind of pressure to have data samples deleted from the database before the database changed hands. So this isn't just an academic concern, I would say.
The situation in France is really interesting because DNA testing there, this commercial DNA testing, is restricted. And there's now talk of police accessing these databases to solve crimes. Now, how big a shift would that be?
I think this goes back to a kind of perennial privacy concern, which is, you know, if you build it, they will come. It's a fairly dated reference now, but that once the capacity is there, and we saw this a lot in Ireland with the discussion around the retention of communications metadata, you know, the information about your telephone calls, for instance, who you called and when, rather than the content of the calls, and about police and security access to that data set. In order to solve crime. We've had a huge line of case law in Europe on this and about the precise safeguards that have to be in place in order to access that type of data, if it's allowed to be retained in the first place. But I think we would have a similar discussion in the context of genetic data, although genetic data is far more potent because it's far more clearly linked to specific individuals. And so there is, of course, the risk there, or the potential there, depending on your perspective, that once these data sets exist, that they can be accessed by police or by security forces. I would say in Europe that there is quite a stringent and well kind of defined legal framework that would apply to that access to data. But again, this becomes more complicated because the vast majority of those genetic data testing companies are based in the US. And they store the data in the US. And so very different provisions, legal provisions, would apply to law enforcement and national security access to the data in the US.
Yeah, and that's, I think, the really important point here. Because first of all, I should say, in the case of 23andMe, I think they were satisfied that there were fairly robust safeguards in place there in defence of that company. But a lot of the companies that you can access are based right around the world, where the protections that are here in Europe, GDPR protections, for example, don't apply.
Exactly. Or even if GDPR protection does apply, it becomes extremely difficult to enforce once there is no kind of physical presence in Europe, even if the laws technically do apply.
So, as I said, this is illegal in France. Would you advocate a similar approach here in Ireland? Because, as I said, they are extremely popular companies. The companies themselves, I'm sure, would argue that they're giving people something meaningful, you know, insight into their identity, that it's a positive thing to contribute to medical research in some cases. You know, are we in danger of focusing too much on the risks and not enough on the benefits?
I definitely have sympathy for the approach taken in France. It's quite a precautionary approach. What I would take away from the French example, or from the French legislation, is that we should perhaps start to think about data like genetic data from a more collective perspective, where we're not simply thinking, is one individual happy with the processing of this data, but we're thinking at a societal level, what are the benefits as a society we get from this genetic data testing, and what are the risks that stem from it? That's a conversation best had at collective level through the legislature and through public debate.
Professor Orla Linsky, thanks so much for joining us on News Talk Daily today.
With pleasure.
And that's it from today's podcast. Love to hear from you as always. Official Kira D is my Instagram. Give me a follow there. Send me any messages or any thoughts you have on what we were discussing today. Until tomorrow, take care. Bye-bye.